Welcome, my name is Divine. This is episode 532 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. This is going to be series 114. Let's begin. So what if they give you a question about a two-month-old child? They tell you that he is brought to the office by his parents for a wellness exam. And you're told that the parents are concerned about a lesion that they find around the child's buttocks. And we're told that, oh, it's a red lesion and it's been growing slowly. And then you're asked, what's the most likely outcome of this lesion? In fact, sometimes they can show you a picture of this lesion. What should you be thinking about? But I really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this sounds a lot like strawberry hemangioma. There are many names they like to use for this on exams. They can call them a strawberry hemangioma. They can call them a capillary hemangioma. But this is something that is pretty high yield to know for your test. And one kind of question I will strongly encourage you to make sure that you're mentally prepared for as you're taking the USMLEs these days is to ask yourself, what is the likely outcome of this disorder? That's one of the ways they love to test prognosis on the USMLEs. Many people ignore it, but trust me, that's a very bad idea. It's a very, very bad idea. So the most likely outcome is it will grow and then it will resolve. It will grow and then it will resolve. Make sure you know that. These hemangiomas, many times, they're vascular. It's not many times. They're pretty much vascular tumors. And they'll grow very quickly. You know, many times from angiogenesis. As you'll see why in a bit. But they grow rapidly from angiogenesis. And then after a while, they just regress over time. So basically, if they were to ask you, what's your next best step in management? Just reassurance. That's pretty much all you need to do. For the parents, right? So again, what are these strawberry hemangiomas? These things are pretty much vascular tumors. That's why it's even called capillary hemangiomas, because you see a lot of capillaries that are filled with blood, and they are mostly separated by, you know, extracellular matrix, like connective tissue, for example. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And usually these things, you don't have to treat them. But if you're kind of concerned, if you're kind of worried, fine. You can give a beta blocker. If it's like very symptomatic or it's like in a kind of a tough spot, you can give a beta blocker, because beta blockers can inhibit angiogenesis. Okay? They can inhibit angiogenesis. So again, remember, these are capillary tumors with a lot of interspersed connective tissue. Very simple. Very, very, very simple. Very, very, very simple. Again, I will try to emphasize some basic science details, because basic science is something our friends at the MBMEs Step 2, Step 3 are concerned about, because that's a way to weed out people that understand from people that are memorizing. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a woman? You're told that she comes for her 20-week visit, and you're told that her amniotic fluid index, you know, she undergoes an ultrasound, an anatomic ultrasound, and we're told that the fetal features are well developed, but that the amniotic fluid index is decreased. And then we're told that, oh, that it is noticed on the fetal ultrasound that one of the fetal kidneys is significantly larger than the other. What should you be thinking about here? I would hope you're saying, Divine, this child has some kind of urinary tract obstruction. This is something that's pretty high yield to know for exams. So what's going on here? What's the pathophys? Well, and let's kind of bring this question together. The first thing you need to understand is that sometimes kids have issues at the level of the ureteropelvic junction, at the level of the ureteropelvic junction. What is the ureteropelvic junction? Well, look at it. Look at these two words smashed together. Uretero. So it tells you that, oh, the ureters are involved here somewhere. Pelvic. That means the renal pelvis. So basically, in a normal situation, there should be appropriate canalization. So that means opening of the tube, the continuous tube, I guess, that is the renal pelvis and the ureter. You know, basically, there should be like a tube that connects both, okay? If that tube is not properly canalized, that's how you get a ureteropelvic junction obstruction. In fact, this is the most common cause, very, very high yield. This is the most common cause of hydronephrosis in a fetus on the USMLEs, especially like a unilateral hydronephrosis, So make sure it's something that you understand. If you see a unilateral hydronephrosis in a fetus or in a newborn on the USMLE exams, and they ask you for the pathophase, they ask you for the mechanism behind it, think of incomplete canalization of the ureteropelvic junction, So it should not come as a surprise to you that, oh, this child has, this woman in her pregnancy, she has a decreased amniotic fluid index. Because remember, a lot of amniotic fluid is fetal urine, at least a constituent of amniotic fluid is fetal urine. So if there's an obstruction to the flow of urine, then that woman's pregnancy is going to be somewhat tenuous. That's why you see the amniotic fluid index is decreased. So you can already begin to see that our friends at the MBMEs can make so many more integrations with this. They can give you a question involving vesicoureteral reflux and basically give you the same Q-stem. They can give you a question that involves posterior urethral valves and essentially give you the exact same Q-stem. These people are going to have oligohydramnios because they are literally not producing adequate amounts of urine. Or if, for example, a child has renal agenesis, for whatever reason, you know, it can happen because of some problem, organic problem in utero, right? Or remember, there are some teratogens that are nephrotoxic, like ACE inhibitors and ARBs. Those things are nephrotoxic. Those things can certainly cause problems. So those things can cause oligohydramnios. But again, it looks like the child in this question has problems with only one kidney. So at least the other kidney is working. So we may be hard-pressed to see the full-blown Porter sequence in this kid. Although, say for example, if both kidneys were not working, or you had like a very crazy significant obstruction, that may cause Porter sequence. Because essentially, if the child is not, the child obviously is making urine or whatever, but the urine has nowhere to go out, right? You'll have significant oligohydramnios. Then the child's face will begin to bang into the walls of the uterus, so they can have like a flat facial profile, right? Their limbs may not be properly developed. And remember, those kids tend to have pulmonary hypoplasia. Why do they have pulmonary hypoplasia? Well, the thing is that amniotic fluid comes into the child's lungs and it expands the fetal lungs. So that amniotic fluid coming into those air bags, basically the lungs, is what makes it develop properly. So if amniotic fluid doesn't get in because you have oligohydramnios, then the fetal lungs will not develop, and that's going to cause pulmonary hypoplasia. Those are the critical things you tend to find in Porter sequence, So please make sure that you know that stuff. So literally, I just said that, oh, the fetal lungs fill with fluid, amniotic fluid. That's what makes it develop. So you can already begin to see that, oh, this may inform some pathophase. I'm just trying to make an integration on another topic. This may inform the pathophysiology behind transient tachypnea of the newborn. So you see a newborn that's born by C-section, because the thing is, vaginal delivery, there is some benefit to it. Vaginal delivery has some benefit to it. What's that benefit? The benefit is that basically, as the child is going through the woman's vagina, there are a bunch of things that are happening, but at least two major things that are exam worthy are happening. Number one, the fluid in the fetal lungs is almost like the woman's vagina is like a laminating press for that fluid. It squeezes fluid out of the fetal lungs. So that's helpful. Two, going through that vagina, look at how small that hole is. You have a fetus going through that. That's going to cause a lot of stress in the fetus. That stress is going to increase fetal cortisol production. That cortisol is going to promote even more lung maturity. But when you're not born by vaginal delivery and you're born by C-section, then you don't have those two things going for you. So there's still going to be fluid in the fetal lung, some amniotic fluid. So the child is going to be breathing really hard to blow that fluid. And many times you're going to see fluid in the fissures on radiographic imaging. Those are the classic things in transit tachypnea of the newborn. All right, enough of integration there. Let's go to something else. So what if they give you a question about a 25-year-old female, and we're told that this female, you know, she has been having really bad breath in the morning. So they may not use the word bad breath on your exams. They'll call it halitosis instead. So she has been having really bad breath in the morning. And then you're told that sometimes she has noticed undigested food in her mouth in the morning. And, you know, she tells you that, you know, she notices that food does not seem to pass down. What is this? Well, I hope you're saying, oh, divine, this sounds an awful lot like echolalia. So what's the pathophase behind echolalia? Well, bunch of things you do need to know. There's actually many different ways our friends at the MBMEs can take echolalia. So what are the different ways they can take echolalia with on the exams? Well, let's start with the pathophase. The thing is, people that have echolalia, they tend to have decreased relaxation of the lower esophageal sphincter. Okay, so sometimes on the exams, instead of putting echolalia on the exam, they'll put a pathophysiological answer, if you may. They'll just put decreased LES relaxation, and that's going to be the right answer. So why does the lower esophageal sphincter have decreased relaxation? Well, the thing is, in echolalia, there's a reduced number of these ganglion cells, of inhibitory ganglion cells. You don't have them because those inhibitory ganglion cells, they're supposed to help with your lower esophagus relaxing. But if you have a decreased number of those neurons that inhibit things, then you're going to get in a lot of trouble. So if your lower esophageal sphincter is not relaxing, then food is not going to pass through. If food does not pass through, then you're going to have dysphagia. Simple as that. And if the food is not passing through, when you become, when you lay supine, then just probably under gravity or whatever, some of that food refluxes back. That's why they have undigested food coming back up in the mornings, you know, overnight. And you'll also notice that these people may have halitosis. So remember, halitosis can, again, be many things on the exams. Halitosis can be what? It can be many things on the exams. In a younger person, maybe think of echolalia, as we're describing here. In an older person, you probably want to think about Zenker's diverticulum. That's an outpouching in the upper esophagus. But let's continue here. So this person has echolalia. Now, sometimes our friends at the MBMEs, they can give you arrows involving an echolalia question. They can literally give you what? Arrows involving an echolalia question. So, for example, what are some classic arrows they love to test? They love to test lower esophageal sphincter pressures, like resting pressures. That's one arrow they love to test. Another arrow they love to test is esophageal motility, or like esophageal peristalsis, especially in the mid-esophagus. Another arrow they love to test is distal esophageal tone. Right. So what should these arrows look like on your exams? Well, number one, let's start with the LES pressures. I've literally just explained that your lower esophageal sphincter pressures are going to be elevated. Okay. Now, what should be true of your esophageal motility, especially your mid-esophageal? Pay attention to that word, mid-esophageal motility. It should be decreased. Your mid-esophageal motility should be what? Decreased. Because think about it. Many people don't process echolalia this way, but echolalia is a nerve problem. Echolalia at its root is a nerve problem. When you have a nerve problem, then peristalsis will not be good. Peristalsis will not be good. So people are going to have decreased mid-esophageal motility. They're going to have decreased mid-esophageal peristalsis, right? And what's going to be true of the lower esophageal sphincter tone is going to be increased. It's going to be elevated, right? And again, remember, how do we manage this? Well, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to do the barium swallow. You're going to do that barium swallow. That barium swallow is going to show you the bird beak sign. Make sure you can identify the bird beak sign for your exams. After that, you're going to do esophageal manometry. That esophageal manometry is what is going to essentially help you. Look at manometry. Whenever a manometer is used to measure pressures. So this is like manometry of the esophagus. All these arrows that I just discussed, how do you think they get those pieces of information? Very easy. They get them through esophageal manometry. It's going to show you decreased mid-esophageal manometry. I mean, decreased mid-esophageal peristalsis, decreased mid-esophageal. Decreased mid-esophageal peristalsis, decreased mid-esophageal motility, right? And it'll show you increased lower esophageal sphincter tone, increased lower esophageal sphincter pressures, right? Because again, they know that people have memorized these algorithms. So our friends at the MBMEs, what do? They just take things a step further. They just take it a step further. Because everyone, I'm sure, has memorized. Number one, Byram swallow. Number two, manometry. Number three, EGD with biopsy. That's the workup. And then, treatment. Well, how do we treat this? Well, you can do a myotomy to treat it. Although there are many other things you can do. You can give like nitrates. You can give you can inject the botulinum toxin. Because remember, the botulinum toxin is gonna decrease. It's gonna decrease the release of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction. So that's going to cause muscle relaxation. So it's going to relax the lower esophageal sphincter. But again, many times you're going to need to get these every 6 months. I know I had an idea. I'll discuss it. I'll get to it in a bit. And another thing you can also do is pneumatic dilation. But again, that's a horrible idea. Many times they like to test pneumatic dilation on the USMLEs as a conduit to esophageal rupture. Because as you're blowing up air in the esophagus, you can pop the esophagus. Those people who have like subcutaneous emphysema, they'll become very, very unstable. That's not a good idea. So the idea was stating is, again, check many Anki decks. You probably have number one, Byram swallow, number two, manometry, number three, EGD with biopsy. If you're testing that on the exams, that makes absolutely no sense. You're not really testing a person's understanding. So what can you do as the USMLEs? Just say, and many times you're reading a question, you're like, okay, well, this fact I knew from my Anki deck, they've done it already. You then wonder, what's the question going to be? And then you start seeing a bunch of arrows and you're like, what? Arrows in achalasia? So again, that's where the deep understanding comes in. That's where what? The deep understanding comes in. Because they'll say, Byram swallow has been done. It shows, a tapered, whatever, distal esophagus. And they love descriptions, by the way, as well. Different story. And then they'll say, esophageal manometry is completed. Which of the followings will most likely be obtained from this diagnostic test or whatever, or from this screening test? And of course, they'll give you a bunch of arrows and things all over the place. That's how you test understanding. That's how the USMLEs look. And I'll just throw in a word here. If you love the way I explain things, or you love a person teaching you how the USMLEs love to put things, I'll strongly encourage you to consider the classes I offer. I have a bunch of classes. It's going to be short. I have a bunch of classes for step one to step three coming up this month, actually starting this Thursday. I have a test taking class on Thursday, biostats class on Friday, social sciences and ethics class on Saturday. They're all for step one to step three. And then starting next week, Monday, I have a 20-hour step two, step three class. And then Saturday, I have a last minute review, a 3-hour class. I have a separate podcast on this you can listen to and get some more information. And then for the step one takers, I have a 25-hour step one review from May 1st to May 5th. Although, if you also are taking step two, step three, and you have a poor basic science foundation, that class is going to be perfect for you. All right, let's go ahead and continue. So what if they give you a question? So please, I guess, to reiterate that point, make sure you're not just memorizing things. Make sure you understand pathophase. Make sure you see how links can be made between different concepts. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? You're told that this person has a long history of severe mitral stenosis and that this person had a valve replacement like 4 weeks ago and that now this person has been having yellowing of their skin. And they give you some labs and you notice that, man, the indirect bilirubin is markedly elevated. What should you be thinking about here? Well, I would hope you're thinking about like a valvular hemolysis. So the prosthetic valve is literally hemolyzing their red cells. And they can even ask you which of the following will most likely be found on a blood smear. I would hope you're seeing divine schistocytes. Schistocytes. So let's kind of put everything together here. Like, what in the world is going on? what in the world is going on? Well, this person got a prosthetic valve. The thing is, prosthetic valves can, some of them can actually begin to lyse your red cells. That's actually a known complication of placing a prosthetic valve. Prosthetic valves can literally lyse red cells. And obviously, if you're lysing red cells, you're going to reduce you're causing an hemolysis. You're pretty much causing an hemolysis. That's going to be like, essentially like an intravascular hemolysis. Remember, there are two kinds of hemolysis. There's like intravascular hemolysis and there's extravascular hemolysis. Because this problem is happening with blood flowing through your body is intravascular hemolysis. So you're going to see a lot of schistocytes on a blood smear. Remember, our friends at the MDMEs, another name you may see for schistocytes are helmet cells. They may literally call these things helmet cells. Or sometimes on your exams, they can even call them fragmented erythrocytes. So please, what are the three ways you may see schistocytes presented on your exams? Number one, they may be called schistocytes. Number two, they may be called fragmented erythrocytes. Number three, they may be called what? Helmet cells. So those things tell you that a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia is probably going on. A microangiopathic hemolytic anemia is probably going on. Or some prosthetic valve is literally chewing up your red cells. Well, think about it, as you chew up your red cells, what's going to happen to your haptoglobin? Your haptoglobin is going to decrease. Your haptoglobin is going to what? It's going to decrease. Your haptoglobin is going to decrease because haptoglobin essentially binds up these broken down red cell fragments. So your haptoglobin is going to decrease. What's going to happen to your indirect bilirubin? Well, your indirect bilirubin is going to skyrocket, right? Your indirect bilirubin is going to skyrocket because remember, as you break down your red cells, you know, you break down the hemoglobin to hemoglobin. That heme, I believe, is converted to like biliverdin. And then that biliverdin is converted to indirect bilirubin. So you're going to have an increase in your indirect bilirubin. Now, another question I think I want to address here is, what will be true of like your LDH? Well, again, a lot of hemolysis is happening. So your LDH is going to go up. Remember, LDH is kind of nonspecific, but it's going to be increased in a person that has intravascular hemolysis. You may notice I'm kind of going a lot with arrows and today, like, you got to know your arrows for your exams, just FYI. So what are some other things that can cause a person to have schistocytes? Well, I talked about the prosthetic cardiac valve. Well, think of other things. Think of other causes of MAHA, microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. Like what? You can see this in a person that has DIC, right? In DIC, DIC is a cause of a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. So you may see schistocytes on a blood smear. If a person has, what else? Divine, come on, think. So DIC is one. Another classic one is HUS. Very good, right? HUS, hemolytic uremic syndrome. Hemolytic uremic syndrome usually is caused by E. coli 0157H7. Is going to, one of the findings, remember, those kids tend to have like acute renal failure, microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. So you see schistocytes on a blood smear. You'll have thrombocytopenia. Those things can be associated with a person having a schistocytes on a blood smear. And then obviously, like the oversized brother of HUS, that's TTP, thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura. That can also cause a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. And you can also find microangiopathic hemolytic anemia in some people that are septic, especially people that have like very severe sepsis. They can have a MAHA as a result of their severe sepsis. So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind as you're studying for your exams. All right. So I think maybe let me address one more vignette and then we'll kind of call it for the day. So what if they give you a question about a 71-year-old male? You're told that he has a very, you know, nasty hypertension. And we're told that, let's see, how do I put this? So he has very nasty hypertension. And you're told that he has flank bruise. So he can auscultate like a bruise in his right flank or whatever. And then you're asked, which of the following is the, I know many of you are like, oh, divine, uncontrolled hypertension, flank bruise, hello, whatever disease you know I'm talking about. But then our friends at the MDMEs throw a curveball. They'll say, oh, which of the following will be the most likely finding on abdominal imaging? And then you're like, Interesting. Well, I'm sure many of you know that I'm clearly talking about renal artery stenosis, but that's not the entire story here. Right? So what are you going to find on imaging? Well, think about it. When you have renal artery stenosis, right? Flank Brewery's, uncontrolled hypertension, old person, whatever. You're not perfusing the kidneys properly. If you're not perfusing the kidneys properly, what do you think is going to happen? The kidney is going to be nickeling and diming itself. And if your kidney is nickeling and diming itself, it's going to shrink, right? So you're going to see atrophy. You're going to see atrophy of that kidney. That kidney that is affected in renal artery stenosis is going to atrophy. It's going to what? Atrophy. So what's the pathophase behind renal artery stenosis? Well, it's basically atherosclerosis. So the problem is with the intima. Remember, blood vessels have three layers. There's the intima, there's the media, and there's the adventitia. So it's an atherosclerotic problem. It's literally atherosclerosis. So let's make a few more integrations here. So if you have atherosclerosis and you're not properly perfusing the kidneys, then what do you think is going to happen? Well, your juxtaglomerular cells are going to freak out. They're going to make tons of renin. That's going to convert angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1. And then that angiotensin 1 in the endothelium of your pulmonary capillaries is going to be converted to angiotensin 2. And angiotensin 2, one of the things it does is that it's going to go to the zona glomerulosa of your adrenal cortex and cause it to make aldosterone. It's also going to go to your pituitary, cause you to make ADH. And angiotensin 2 is also a powerful vasoconstrictor. So you can see many forces at play that's causing a person to be hypertensive. Number one, you're having very powerful vasoconstriction. That's going to raise your systemic vascular resistance. That's going to jack up your blood pressure. Number two, aldosterone, remember in the kidneys, it causes you to reabsorb sodium and water. So that's going to raise your blood volume. That's also going to raise your blood pressure. And aldosterone is going to make you excrete out potassium. So it's going to cause you to become hypokalemic. Another thing aldosterone also does is to make you excrete hydrogen ions in your kidneys. As you excrete those hydrogen ions, you're going to have a metabolic alkalosis. So please keep that in mind. And again, they may not even mention it as a flank brewery on your exams. They may just mention an abdominal brewery. And I guess one thing I want to compare and contrast this with is, and usually if you want to diagnose this, you can do a Doppler ultrasound of the renal arteries. Many times what these people get is just blood pressure control. But if the blood pressure control is not working, then you should consider angioplasty. Of that renal artery. All right. So compare and contrast this with fibromuscular dysplasia. Fibromuscular dysplasia is a problem with the media of the artery. The media is the muscle layer of the artery. Fibromuscular dysplasia is not atherosclerotic disease of the renal arteries. It's not an intimal problem. It's a medial problem. That's something that's lost on many people as they prepare for the exams. The symptoms may be similar, but the pathophase is different. Renal artery stenosis is an intimal problem. Fibromuscular dysplasia is a medial problem. And I know classically on the exams, fibromuscular dysplasia, they tend to test it in younger females. But I'm going to tell you this, actually, if I'm not mistaken, the most common age demographic for fibromuscular dysplasia is a middle-aged woman. So don't be shocked if they give you a fibromuscular dysplasia question in a middle-aged woman. And usually, what are you going to find on imaging? You're going to see that string of beads pattern. You're going to see what? That string of beads pattern with the renal arteries. That tells you that, oh, this is fibromuscular dysplasia. Remember, what if you see the string of beads pattern with a mesenteric vessel in a person that has high inflammatory labs? What are you thinking about? I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this is polyarteritis nodosa. What if you see a string of beads pattern? Let's throw in one more integration here. What if you see a string of beads pattern with your biliary tree? Ooh, that's PSC. That's primary sclerosing cholangitis, right? So there's many ways they can test those string of beads. So you'll see like basically a series of normal or, you know, you'll see like alternating normal segments of whatever tube and dilated segments. So they may not use string of beads. They may describe it. They'll say, oh, alternating, you know, it'll be some tube, whatever tube, alternating normal and dilated, normal, dilated, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind for exams. I think we're kind of getting close to 30 minutes here. So I'm going to go ahead and stop. But again, I will encourage you, if you're interested in any of my classes, shoot me an email through the website, or you can email me at divineinterventionpodcasts with an S at the end, divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. And also made a separate podcast where I give some more information on the classes. And I offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams. And I tutor for med school exams and shelf exams as well. And then I have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. So please check those out. I have a YouTube channel where I post the videos that I make. And then I have also help with ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements, and stuff like that. And then both for people trying to get into med school and people trying to get into residency or fellowship. And then I also have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I post two podcasts where from a biblical perspective, I explain a life lesson. Many people listen to it and find it to be very helpful. I usually post the podcast on Fridays and Sundays, usually about 10 minutes long. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. So thank you for joining me today. I hope you find this podcast to be helpful. I'll see you in the next episode. God bless you. Bye for now. Thank you.